Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwindiger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some cybersecurity and technology news headlines and hopefully provide some insight and analysis and practical application that you can take back into the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
You know, Matt, I wonder if Microsoft is going to start adding dead cybersecurity professionals like Bruce Schneier as security co-pilots to its E5 license scheme.
Wait, Bruce Schneier died?
Well, accidents do happen.
Ah! All right, for our first article today, this will sound unrelated to security, but we're going to get there eventually. We will bend it. I saw this article on the Register. I think, are all of our articles from the Register this week again?
No, just most.
Just 3 out of 4. You know, though, it makes sense, though, because there's a bunch of outlets that all write an article based on kind of the same stuff. Like, you could go to like 10 different outlets and find an article on this. We just love the Register. All right. The article is just $10 to create an AI chatbot of a dead loved one. Jason Rohrer, an indie games developer, built Project December, an AI-powered chatbot trained on text messages from the dead, so you can have conversations with dead folks.
Well, you can simulate conversations with dead folks.
Oh.
Not actually talk to
dead people. I misunderstood.
Yeah, this is not the Sixth Sense.
I thought it was just like a Ouija board.
It's a Ouija board, but instead of the puck, it's a mouse.
You know, actually, that'd be kind of cool if you could set one of these up yourself so that after you die, you can harangue your descendants. You could like call them, have it trained in your voice, and you call them and you're like, have you got a job yet?
Oh, I should have looked that up before that, but there was what the heck was it called? It's like Project Lifetime or something like that, or life journaling. I forget the terminology for it. And some people have actually done this, where they literally record everything.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, you're right. You could use that to feed a really, really good model.
Yeah, I mean, if you record everything, I would think that would probably make a pretty good model of you over the entire course of your life, especially if you talk to yourself.
Constantly narrating what you're doing every day, all day long. Yeah.
Oh, like an old radio show. Oh, and I'm going to pick up this pickle.
Oh, that's what you call it. All right. Anyways, before we get too crazy. So I didn't really want to talk about the dead people living forever thing, although I did see a suggestion. I don't remember if it was in this article or another one. Did see a suggestion that this is going to be the equivalent of uploading yourself to the Matrix. You're not going to upload yourself. You're going to upload an AI of yourself. But what I want to talk about was about simulating live people. And the reason is losing tribal knowledge is a big concern among companies. If a security engineer who's worked for your company for a decade decides to leave next week and get paid a whole lot more money than your stupid company was not paying him, you usually get like 2 weeks to do some knowledge transfer. It's never enough. There's always questions afterwards that you're like, man, why did we set this up this way? How did we do this? Where does the documentation live? And especially the average tenure in a security role is 2 to 3 years. We're constantly like building and then losing tribal knowledge. Build, lose, build, lose. So what if your company put all of your emails and chats for a person into an AI bot as part of when you leave the company so you could answer questions after you left?
Well, I think you need to add more to that too, because that's only going to catch a slice. So you also want to capture all their Zoom meetings and the transcripts from their Zoom meetings or their phone calls or in-person meeting recordings and everything. If you really want to get the full gamut here, because emails and chat's only part of it. I'm sure, obviously, it's more today than it was in the past since more people are remote. But I think that would still only get a slice of what you're looking for.
You're not wrong. And given that more and more models are going to be trained, I think that more companies are going to start recording all of that stuff to include just in general. So that wouldn't surprise me. But I mean, even for people that are still at the company, how many times have you answered the same question that people have asked you over and over again? Because maybe you announced something at a meeting and they didn't pay attention. They come back 2 weeks later. Hey, when's going to be the release date for such and such? Or how are we supposed to escalate this? Like, it's all information. It's a search problem. It's a finding the information problem, which is frankly what ChatGPT is really good at. Jana Meisler just had an article talking about how he thinks the killer application for the chat-specific AI is going to be for tutorials. Because sure, there's, you know, dozens, perhaps hundreds of good tutorials on the internet about, say, how to use TCP dump. The problem is not that the information is not there. The problem is finding the information. So what if these AI chatbots can, you could train it on your stuff like as you're going. And when somebody sends you an email, you can tell it to go to the chatbot first. And then if the chatbot doesn't find anything that it has a high confidence level is the answer, then it forwards it to you.
Actually, that just made me think this will tie into the next article we're going to talk about. But when you do instant handling and there's an instant, you should have like almost two groups. You know, one group that interfaces with the incident team and management, and then the one that manages the incident down. So imagine if you replace the one that talks to the management with an AI bot that simply has access to all the incident data that's going on in the course of the incident.
Yeah, and they could query it and say, you know, when did it start? And it would just go through the information you have and be like, it started on Thursday, April, whatever.
Right. You know, what's the current status? You know, and that kind of thing.
Might not be too bad. We're ready to fire a whole bunch of people, apparently.
That's the goal, obviously.
That's the goal. Yeah. Yeah. So would you, so I guess my first question here is, would you think they'd have a separate bot for each person, or would you just train a single bot on all the folks who have left and kind of have a generic bot that answers questions?
Yeah, I think you'd want the latter, because training it for the individuals, that'd be something you'd want to do in order to like capture their personality or the uniqueness about that individual versus the amalgamation of all the security information that they had accumulated along with everybody else. So I think you just want one, and then their stuff would just be added on top of that one corporate security AI.
Yeah, because you care about the information, you don't care about the personality, like you said. And you would end up with a different problem. You'd be like, all right, so which one do I ask about this? which of the engineers that I never met that was here 3 years ago knows, you know, where the bodies are buried, so to speak?
Yeah, and then they disagree and you got two AIs arguing each other, and then the knives come out and, you know, one AI gets shanked in the bathroom. And I mean, it's just terrible.
I was really worried about that.
I know.
I can also see having a bot as a cultural bot. And when I say culture, so for example, if your company uses the Toyota production system, or it has like a specific way that it likes doing things, it would be very helpful to have a bot that, especially a chat format, where you could be like, hey, you know, we are about to run a problem solving process or something like that. What's the company approved method for doing this? Which it goes back to what I was talking about before, where the chatbot is a tutorial effectively, and it can just like kind of teach or tell the person how the company wants certain things to be run.
Right. And you tie that into standards and policy. That would seem to be pretty straightforward, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've gone searching for the travel policy and rereading the travel policy to try and figure out if a certain thing is permitted, or, you know, what's the threshold for, you know, picking a different flight, et cetera.
I wonder how long before, you know, this kind of thing gets kind of used for propaganda. You know, we've modeled, you know, John Wayne, and John Wayne would tell you to buy Schlitz beer or something like that.
Ooh, yeah. I mean, they already kind of did that with the fake Yul Brynner after he died, the advertisement to Yul Brynner.
Oh, well, they've done several advertisements with dead people. As a matter of fact, John Wayne, they did one as well. AI. They just used his image.
Yeah. This would be more persistent. Can you imagine them standing up like, have a chat with John Wayne with the AI, and then you talk to him and like he just sticks it in there. He just like inserts it in at various points.
Oh, yeah. You're talking to him and he's like, man, I could go for a Schlitz right now.
Yeah. But anyway. Like that. Yeah. It'd be a lot more subtle and a lot more like people would be like, oh man, John Wayne likes Schlitz. I should.
Right. I mean, that's less concerning from, you know, entertainment icons like that kind of idea. But if they go in, they say, well, we model Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, and John Quincy Adams. And according to our AI model, their personalities, they believe we should go with this policy, you know, which is, of course, kill all the brown people.
Oh boy. Yeah, that would be. That'd be interesting because, yeah, you're appealing to people's natural patriotism. You're appealing to people that might be like, well, of course, Abraham Lincoln would be. And if you, but again, like the inputs for this AI change so much and people change over time too. You could model somebody in their 20s and then model somebody in their 50s and they'd be wildly different.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the idea is you capture it over time because, you know, Thomas Jefferson, all these people, their thoughts and ideas evolved, you know, as they did, as they grew and got older and everything like that. But I think it's what I think that kind of the whole COVID fiasco kind of proved this out, though, that regardless of the apprehension that you and I may have about the models and everything, but when this is couched to the public, when they say, oh, 20 million people are going to die unless we do X because we modeled it.
Yeah.
The average person doesn't understand what that means.
Yeah, yeah.
And that there could be errors in the model and mistakes with the model. They said, well, if we don't do this, then that's going to happen, as if it's a foregone conclusion because they don't publish the models. They're going to be black box models. So well, they have idea what that means or you know, how close it is to being models. Right. Right. Well, I mean, the models that they used for the COVID were black box too, but this is even going to be even more so. So
fair enough.
Yeah, I think that idea right there, which I just thought of when we were prepped for the podcast, is pretty scary, I think.
Yeah.
Because of people's acquiescence to authority and computer models, because
yeah, if you model that, it's gotta be right.
Right. Exactly. It's math. It's just math.
It's just math.
So math can't be wrong, even though it can be.
Yeah. That recent weirdly enough, I was just listening to, I think we talked before about a Hard Fork. Mm-hmm. Which is a technology podcast who's been talking a lot about this type of thing recently, AI. And they were having a conversation with Ezra Klein. And that was one of the things he was saying, that he thinks that AI should be just straight up made illegal and should not be allowed to do propaganda and advertising, because he's worried that it would be too effective. Of course, we can ban it all we want to in the US, but who knows?
Yeah, well, they've already done that in Italy. And what I heard, the result is that is, you know, increased use of VPNs. So, you know, it doesn't really stop it. It's almost like nuclear weapons, you know. Yeah. Since it's in existence, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. It's too late.
Yeah. Well, then we'll just ban VPNs and only criminals will have VPNs. All right. We've talked a lot about this. But one of the things that David mentioned when we were talking about this earlier this week when we were putting this together was John Scalzi has a book series called The Interdependency. And one of the items in there is that each of the previous emperoxes, they call them, which is, you know, their fancy sci-fi word for emperor, is turned into an AI and is available for consulting. And I think that that's going to start to be a thing going forward. I think we're going to see a service like we just talked about, where a company will offer, we will build an AI off you, you know, come in and share all your writings with us and answer our interviews, and we'll have, you know, exhaustive interview, and we'll videotape you, and we'll model you, and we'll produce an AI so you can, you know, your family can come and visit you forever afterwards. And then they won't, because they're going to be like, that's creepy, Dad. Where are you?
Yeah, I didn't want to talk to you when you were alive, obviously.
But it'll be great for historians. Historians will be able to consult like actual people that lived, but, you know, 500 years ago.
Well, it comes down to what we were talking about before. You know, is it really going to be an accurate representation or not? I don't know. Yeah. As a matter of fact, you know, something that, you know, I just thought of, there's also that relates to Westworld, the Westworld TV series that HBO put out, which is fantastic, by the way. Absolute must watch.
I still haven't seen it.
Oh, it's great. But in that, they have these robots, obviously, and one of the goals of the company behind the Westworld was to be able to learn enough about people that they could faithfully recreate their personality and put it into a robot.
Oh, boy.
And they called it, and I forget the term now, or something like faithful or something that, you know, to make it, oh man, it's annoying they missed that word. But anyway, that's what they were shooting for as the whole premise behind the reason that the even Westworld existed, was to actually learn about people and their what they do, what they think and everything, because that was supposed to be like Westworld. The idea of it was basically you could be your true self in Westworld because it was all make-believe.
Right. And didn't people turn into basically murderous?
Some people did. Some people were horrible. And one of the main characters, played by Ed Harris, is a terrible, terrible guy who didn't start off that way. But you see his evolution in a couple series, or was it either one episode or a series of episodes in the middle of the series that shows his migration from or maybe it's just the realization of who he really was to begin with anyway, was from what seemed like a average nice guy into, you know, a heinous killer.
Well, that's horrifying.
Oh, right. Probably should have caveated that with spoiler alert.
All right. It's funny. We have spent like 10 minutes on this, and this is supposed to be like a throwaway first article. So let's keep moving. So why does this matter? It doesn't right now, but you're just going to see so many weird use cases around AI. And we'll talk about this later. Actually, the next article, we're going to kind of talk about this as well.
All right. And the next article is Microsoft Security Copilot is a new GPT-4 AI assistant for cybersecurity. This comes to us from The Verge. So apparently, and this is not the only Copilot Microsoft has. So they have the GitHub Copilot, and they've got a Microsoft 365 Copilot. So this is Copilot is just like what Microsoft is now naming their AI assistants, apparently.
Yeah, and it makes sense. It's a good name. I just wasn't expecting it. I don't think they made it clear that this is like a class of stuff, not just... I was just really confused when they announced Copilot. I was like, wait a second, don't they already have this?
Yeah, I know. It puts me a little bit off. I don't particularly like that name because I've heard, and maybe this is just where I grew up or where I'm living now, is that I often hear God is my co-pilot or Jesus is my co-pilot. And so this puts it in a bad light for me that, you know, I don't want this kind of stuff associated with the divine because it's right. Or, you know, because it's a misequivalency.
Fair enough. So this is much like what Daniel Meisler and probably others that I haven't read, but since I, you know, exhaustively read his stuff, this is what they've hypothesized, I'm betting. It seems to consist of a public model based on GPT-4 and then a private security-specific model created by Microsoft, which they say is feeding into the security-specific model the 65 trillion daily signals, which I believe are from the Microsoft Graph API.
Well, that's just a broken light that's blinking, though.
You know, I've looked at some of the Microsoft alerts and I wonder how much actual useful information they'd be able to get out of that.
Yeah, it's kind of the misassumption that more is better. You know, how many of that 65 trillion is actually good signal versus noise? I mean,
you know, for a while, actually, so Microsoft has a couple different alert types, some of which were exceptionally useful for a long time. Like, for example, they used to have, or they still have a... you know, user logged in from a strange location alert, which I'm sure is based on some sort of behavioral analytics. And it'll tell you, you know, this person always logs in Ohio and today they logged in from Nigeria. I can't tell you where that example came from. It was completely random.
that does seem odd.
And for a while, they were accurate enough that you could action them directly. Like they were, I found them about 60, 70% accurate. And then they changed their algorithm and we suddenly were getting like 10 times more of them and they were no longer nearly as accurate. They made it a lot more sensitive. But yeah, this is, I'm sure those events they're talking about are the, because they've got antivirus events in Office 365 when you upload stuff to SharePoint and Teams and such. They have things like anomalous logins, impossible travel, you know, failed two-factor authorization, all kinds of stuff like that. I'm sure that's all feeding this.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the email ones, like if you've got their email security stuff, like if a user received a phishing email or something or clicked, like they now have link protection in Teams and link protection in the emails. So if you click a malicious link, that'll be an alert.
Well, maybe they shouldn't have let that email arrive with the link in it, maybe.
Well, sometimes they don't know till afterwards.
Just the moment you click it, they could sense that it was bad.
Well, I mean, there's a lag time between when you receive it. And then also, as long as they have the link proxied, they can tell afterwards as well.
Well, some email clients, they do the link lookup before, you know, or upon delivery or at delivery time.
I don't know how they do it, so I couldn't tell you. I haven't studied how Microsoft handles this.
No, poorly. But anyway, it has a chat-like interface, so you know, so the text box, and what they call a pin board where analysis can collaborate. And this actually reminded me of that tool we've talked about a couple of times before. And the name always eludes me, that does the screen scraping and highlights the text on the screen based on incident data. What the heck is the name of that tool, Matt?
Something.io. Polarity.io? Is that it?
Polarity, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. I still really want to try that because I think that's... I want to try it.
Yeah. We should get them to sponsor.
As long as they don't ask us how many ads we have, we'll be good.
So... but this is supposed to help the analysts investigate and report is the whole point of this AI. And it also has what they call a prompt book feature, which is basically a collection of steps or automations that they put into a single prompt. So it's kind of like, I think, you know, in the chat, you'd be able to like say, hey, execute this workbook kind of thing.
Yeah,
and then
they
it would run off a series of tasks is what I understood that to mean.
They had it in their demo, but they didn't show how they got to it. They just showed that there was like a little thing that was a malware reverse engineering prompt book where it ran a bunch of queries like reverse engineer this. Then, you know, show us a graphic of how it compromises the system and what it does and then do this. But they didn't show like how you bring the prompt book up. Like how do you access that? So,
oh yeah, I read that blog post, but I forgot to, I didn't click on the video.
Yeah, I went to find it because I saw there was, I was like, oh, show me.
Promises, promises. But they also have, they've also included here error reporting. So if the AI gets something wrong, you'll be able to provide some kind of feedback. And they claim it's more than the thumbs up, thumbs down.
Couldn't find
Not a lot of detail behind that though.
Yeah. Yeah. They said that you'd be able to tell it exactly what it got wrong. And in the demo, they showed where it said something about Windows 9 and they were like, there is no Windows 9. This is obviously wrong. But then they didn't show how they were reporting it. They also showed in the demo where it cites its sources. So that's also kind of cool. If you're familiar with the sources, you may be able to look at those and be like, why would they say that? And then go look it up.
Oh, you know, that might also help doing things in an automatic fashion in relation to insiders and policy violation stuff. Because if it were consuming all your standards and policies, you know, presumably it would be able to tell based on log data that you violated the policy or whatever, you know, flag it, create an incident, send you to remedial training and close it or something like that in an automated fashion.
Interesting. Yeah.
That might be helpful for, you know, user education in order to prevent those kinds of accidental incidents.
Yeah.
But since this is in beta, but they're offering limited access to, I wonder how useful this is going to be or how long they're going to have it trained on. You know, they're going to allow companies to train on the beta before they make it generally available. They didn't give a timeline in the blog post or the article.
Yeah, I know I've already been kind of pushing around to try and see if I can get access to it, but it looks like a lot of people are being very hesitant right now about getting into this. There's lots and lots of privacy concerns, and we'll talk about that kind of stuff later. But I did see a couple things that were kind of interesting in this article. It was very general. If you go into the Microsoft blog has more information, and it's got a 3-minute video demo, which is very constrained and only shows you a few things. But so here's a quote from the blog post. Quote, attackers hide behind noise and weak signals. Defenders can now discover malicious behavior and threat signals that could otherwise go undetected. That sounds like a SIEM replacement, because that sounds like risk-based alerting or user behavior analytics.
I mean, it also could be an accurate description of everything security does.
Trying to find signal in the noise. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fair.
Yeah. Good marketing speak. It sounds scary.
Marketing speak. Well, I mean, but Microsoft produces all those alerts and you don't have time to go look at all those alerts because they're all super noisy. Finding a way. Well, all right. Anyways. Yeah. Yeah.
I think, this is more equivalent to providing data enrichment. So you have a broader filter, which is like the SIEM, which narrows it down to more specific stuff you're concerned about. And then you focus the AI on that stuff versus have it look at, you know, everything in replacing the SIEM, at least to start with now, I think, because the amount of computational power necessary, I'm not sure that would work out right now anyway for pointing the AI at everything versus a pre-selected filter.
Yeah. This also sounds like it might be a SOAR replacement. They're talking about the prompt book with the steps and automations. I mean, isn't that basically SOAR at a high level? Here's another quote from the blog post. Security Copilot delivers critical step-by-step guidance and context through a natural language-based investigation experience that accelerates instant investigation and response. Now, maybe not a SOAR, maybe a workflow platform, or I don't know.
It almost seems like it would be a natural language interface to the SOAR, because the SOAR would have the integrations built in and the predefined actions built within it. And then you'd use the AI as the natural language interface to execute those things, I would think.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about how I think SOAR is going to go. And I need to put together a blog post about that, actually, because I have I have many things to say about SOAR and AI. So another quote on here, before I get into that, your point about the connections is important. It sounds like this thing is going to have connections to all the Microsoft tools at release, of which a number of them are fairly important and useful, like to be able to remove emails from inboxes, to be able to, you know, block incoming email addresses. But Microsoft isn't running a proxy. Microsoft isn't running, I guess they are running an AV/EDR. So they you might be able to do things like block hashes on endpoints.
Yeah. But, well, I think you're gonna get this out of the gate for anything Azure and anything Microsoft 365. But if you're running on-prem Microsoft, I think that'll be a phase two, and third party will be at a phase 974 or something like that.
Well, yeah, because they're going to try and convince you. I bet this is only available if you've got E5 or
right. Because that, I mean, it's like the, what the heck did they call it? The P or APT?
Mm-hmm. AT, Advanced Threat Protection.
Advanced Threat Protection used to only come with E5, or was it E3? I know you had to have a certain Microsoft license before you got the additional level of security, which actually made the Microsoft security stuff useful. So I think they're going to put that at the same kind of price point or try to put it in the same place.
Yeah. I would believe that they're talking about this is only available to a few people. I bet it's available to the highest, the ones that are most committed.
Most committed or the ones that are spending the most money?
Isn't that the same thing? Isn't that how Microsoft would measure commitment?
Maybe.
That's fair.
Because it could be one company bought all the things, but another one bought more of less things. So they're spending more money. I don't know. I'm just saying there are different equivalents or different ways of measuring that. Either way, I'm not in that boat. So, from the shore.
Yeah. I have another quote from here that sounds interesting. Quote, a growing list of unique skills and prompts that elevate the experience of security teams and set the bar higher for what is possible even under limited resources. And this kind of hits on what I really want from a SOAR. I want to see what other folks are doing, and I want to steal from them liberally. Right now, if you
mean
buy
constantly.
Constantly. Liberally and constantly. Like most SOARs now, you buy them and they come with a couple of default playbooks, depending on the SOAR. But generally, the default playbooks are very generic because they're designed to try and work with as much as possible. And then every company has to either build their own or customize and tailor the playbooks down. I think that's where AI, and again, I have a whole other rant on AI and SOAR, but that's where AI could be super helpful, where it can tailor those playbooks down for you and let you run other people's stuff. And it kind of happens now, sort of. For example, Palo Alto XOR, they have a marketplace where you can upload a playbook. But again, with automation as it stands right now, when you pull down that playbook, you have to tailor it to your environment. You've got to make sure it uses the same integrations you have. You have to make sure it fits with your processes. If you have an AI that's trained on your local processes and your local integrations, it should be able to just go out there and find the playbook you want and then adjust it so it works with your stuff.
Yeah, I think at least initially you're going to have to do all that yourself, because it's not going to work like the daemon from Daniel Suarez's book, where it figures this stuff out for you all on its own. I think, you know, from a force perspective, I think it's going to kind of start off like the old automated phone prompts, right? So you'd call up a company and they would say, I'm a computer, but I understand human language and you can ask me the following questions.
It never understands me.
Well, that's your terrible redneck accent.
I'll be damned. I don't even know what a redneck accent is. I should. My parents are from Arkansas.
You are from the South.
Another interesting quote I found in here was, a security copilot also comes with skills that represent the expertise of security analysts in areas such as threat hunting, incident response, and vulnerability management. If you're automating threat hunting, isn't it basically just an alert?
Well, threat hunting, I mean, it will only be alert if it actually finds something bad. Part of threat hunting is also identifying monitoring gaps or other gaps in your security. So it would have to be able to do both of those things. So I think the AI is smart enough to pivot based on what it finds during the threat hunt. I'm not sure how well it would work out for a threat hunt.
Yeah, I don't know that I believe that that's going to be a big thing. So I spoke with a SOC a couple of years ago, where they do an interesting thing. After they do a fresh threat hunt, they turn it into a piece of content that runs weekly. And then it goes into the analyst queue. so the analyst can continue to work on it each week when the threat hunt runs. I could see that being a useful place where an AI could, you know, compare week to week results and be like, this looks weird.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. One of the things that was mentioned in here also is like, the AI is not supposed to replace analysts, but that's what you and I have been talking about for a long time, is actually replacing analysts with automation, replacing the tier ones. So I think this is definitely a step in that direction. So while they may say it, they probably say it for marketing reasons that they can't come out and say, yeah, we're replacing humans.
Yeah, that would be that'd be a non-starter.
Yeah, you end up getting the Luddites throwing their wooden shoes into the Microsoft code or something.
I don't know if that. Yeah, and at the very least, you're going to be able to stop. I mean, because they talk earlier about how it's going to, I think what we'll find out first is that it's not going to replace people at first. They're going to use it to expand capabilities and expand breadth and find more stuff. But then as people leave, they're just going to not hire a replacement. And maybe some more, you know, more ruthless companies may start firing people. But I think a lot of people are just going to be like, oh, you know what? We don't need 6 analysts anymore. We can get by fine with 5. Oh, we don't need 5 analysts anymore. We can get by with 4.
Right. So basically, they're just going to start cutting billets as people leave and just stop refilling them, which is probably the best way to go about it and would cause the least amount of friction in any organization. So that would probably be a good methodology.
Yeah, if they actually do it that way.
Yeah, because the thing is, that also provides you a gradient scale of maturity, right? So you don't have to get rid of that analyst until you reach the point where you think you're comfortable getting rid of them. But, you know, we talked a minute ago about the turnover rate. So this is going to be multi-years long project anyway. So I think, you know, 18 months or whatever, or a year to get to the next threshold. Because if, you know, let's say you're not at that threshold yet, so you hire a new analyst. So you just have to wait 18 months or so before the next opportunity at the most, before that, you know, you have another opportunity to leave a billet empty.
Yeah. Yeah. Although at some point people will recognize what's happening and they may stop leaving, or they may not be able to get another job as an analyst somewhere else because nobody's hiring.
No, it could be. But I mean, if Microsoft, you know, we were talking about Microsoft tying this to the higher licenses, though, not everybody can afford those. So there are other companies are still going to need analysts.
Oof. Yeah. That's going to be interesting, where we create the have and have not society, where basically some companies are able to move faster with fewer people because they're leveraging AI. And then other companies are still kind of stuck. Anyways. So I do wonder how they're going to do reinforcement learning from this. So generally speaking, the way most of these large language models work is they build up the model and then the model can spit out answers, but those answers are frequently wrong. So then they use reinforcement learning from human feedback, where they have a bunch of humans review the answers and then give the large language model feedback, like, this is good, this is bad. Although I'm sure that's what they're doing right now with their subset of experienced customers. But knowing how bad many analysts are, if they try and incorporate this from their broad based, we're going to end up with a lot of weird errors.
Yeah, unless they have some kind of second level of quality control on top of the customers to double check that, you know, maybe, or they only do reinforcement learning on the beta stuff, which they're only giving to, you know, really good organizations or consultant companies like Mandiant or something that are known to be better on average.
Yeah.
Than other places.
You know, though, but couple problems with that. Number one, I guess one problem with that, their data is going to get out of, it's like you said, they're going to have people that are doing reinforcement learning all the time, because otherwise their model is going to get stale. They're going to have to be continuously updating. Otherwise, a new technique comes out using a new vector and it's just going to miss it completely. So
maybe it depends on how different it is.
Yeah. If it's just like a slight modification of an existing one, it'll probably still catch it. But so something my wife actually pointed out this morning, we were talking about this as I was prepping it. She asked how, because we were talking about the reverse engineering. She was like, well, I'm not a reverse engineer. If I was an analyst and it spit out a reverse engineering thing and told you what it did, how would I know that that was correct? And I was like, well, you wouldn't. You need people who are experienced enough to interpret this to be able to tell if it's hallucinating or not. And at some point, if these models replace the tier one analysts, and then we companies stop needing most malware reverse engineers, we're going to run out of people that know how to do these things. And this goes back to what you were talking about, where people just trust the model for propaganda.
At least in the interim, what I think this is another opportunity or another market niche that could be filled is a company that just does that, just does the validation.
Like an underwriter's lab, but for models.
Right.
So currently, we need to speed this up. We're taking way too long on this. Currently, it integrates with Microsoft's complete security portfolio. So I guess we're all going to get E5 eventually.
Being forced into the E5 model anyway.
Yeah, E5 is so expensive. It does make a quick mention that it will use information from your other tools, but it goes into no detail on that. Like David said, that's probably, phase 27. It does talk a little bit about privacy, which is interesting because one of the articles that I considered adding to this was there was a recent article about how Samsung discovered on at least three occasions where internal data was submitted to ChatGPT. And there was another one where a doctor fed a patient's personal information into ChatGPT and asked it to write a letter to the insurance. And like David mentioned earlier, ChatGPT is banned in Italy because it's supposedly not GDPR compliant. So that's interesting. Microsoft's going to have a uphill battle to fight over in Europe.
Well, they got plenty of money.
Microsoft's blog post says it's privacy compliant. They say they do not use your data to train the foundational AI model, which makes me wonder if they have a personalized model that runs over the top of the foundational. Because when they describe it, they talk about there's the ChatGPT model, there's the security model. And it makes me wonder if there's a third model that runs on top of that that basically has all of your information.
Yeah, I'm thinking that what they need to do, rather than making a blanket statement like that, is more like come up with a subscription model where you've got basically like multi-tenant and single tenant. So multi-tenant, they get to use the AI, all their data gets put into the AI, and everybody who subscribes to the multi-tenant model, that's the way it works. Just everybody's stuff goes in there and everybody's stuff gets used. And then you have the single tenant where you're able to leverage all that stuff that everybody else is throwing in there, but then your stuff is able to reinforce your part, but is not fed into the foundational part.
Yeah.
So you get the benefit of everybody else and your stuff, but your stuff is not fed back into and possibly exposed to anyone else.
And I wish they would force you to expose your... This is one of the reasons why security moves so slow. Like, this is a big problem in the SOAR and the SIEM space. Everybody, so let's say you use Splunk. You get Splunk. Now, Splunk has been better about this in the last couple of years. They've started producing content, but their content fairly works out of the box. You've got to edit it and modify it and get it to work in your environment. But you break out your new Splunk SIM installation that they promised you is going to help you find the bad guys. And you're like, all right, we turned it on. Where are the bad guys? Oh, wait, first you have to develop all of your content. First, you have to write all of your playbooks for SOAR. It'd be so much better if you could feed anonymized data back. And everybody is so afraid of sharing security-related data. This drives me nuts.
Well, AI might be able to help with that if you can convince them that you've created the model that is good enough to perform that sanitization of your data when it gets fed back in.
That would be good. Yeah. No, I'd appreciate that a lot.
But of course, it comes down to you'd have to trust it and it's got to be done correctly and reinforced and blah, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Goes back to the fundamental challenges of teaching the AI or training the AI.
They also said something in there about how you can choose how to monetize your data. Does that mean you can sell your data to Microsoft or other users? I mean, we talked the other week about having a specific, when we talked about the SPQA stuff from Daniel Meisler, we talked about having a person-specific policy model. Like, we want the Bruce Schneier policy model or the Richard Baitlick policy model. It would be cool if you could do the same as an analyst. You work a couple hundred example incidents and then sell your AI trained model of yourself as an analyst AI, the Matthew AI, it's really good against business email compromise, but not so good against malware.
Maybe that's another way that they talk about the shortage of cybersecurity folks. Maybe when we get farther down this path, then that could be part of an employment contract. Say, hey, you come here and you do great security stuff. We will let you as your AI and feed that back into Microsoft or something like that. That could be part of your compensation package or a bonus or something like that.
But then they're going to be like, but that's part of your compensation. Yeah. But, and what would be interesting there too, as well, is that then you can, what am I thinking of? Then you can get a bunch of different analyst AIs, because you probably wouldn't want just a single analyst AI. You would want to see different, like I said, like one of them, if they're based on humans, humans are good at different things, but you would want like, who's the best business email compromise analyst in the business? We're going to pay them $500,000 to just, you know, give us an AI of them. Who's the best reverse engineer malware? And then you're going to have like second and third tier analysts that are still way better than the people you find, you know, hiring in Cleveland. That'd be interesting.
I wonder how many of those you would need.
I mean, this is the same thing we get with everything, where the best, the people at the top, or the people with, not even the best, the people with the best marketing are going to get the lion's share of the money. And then there's going to be a long tail of people that are going to make way less money than those top ones.
Right. But if you were going to build an AI, you know, bench, how many would you need? You know, you want a phishing one, you want a reverse engineer one, you want a forensics one, yeah, et cetera, et cetera, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, I think you'd want a couple because you can compare them, and then you could have, what you could do is you could run everything past like 5 phishing AIs, and then anything where 3 out of the 5 agree or 4 out of the 5 agree, you take action on.
Or maybe you'd be able to get an AI per incident category according to the way you categorize incident. Just go that way. Everybody would want all the things, but yeah. I'm saying, yeah. But you have 5 different categories of incidents, right? You have a phishing incident, you have a data breach incident or whatever. You know, you have an AI specialized for each one of those.
Oh, but that's the thing is,
you're saying you'd have multiple for each.
Yeah, because again, you've got hallucinations and you've got other potential issues. I don't think you'd want to just trust one. That's all.
Well, yeah. Well, we're obviously talking about in an ideal world because,
yeah, that's
you right. know, that doubles your cost or triples your cost or whatever, depending on
but
how
I
many.
Still think the cost is going to be less than a single analyst.
Most likely.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what we're going to get is you're going to get like, you know, because the analyst that's selling it, you know, they sell it for $10,000 a year or $20,000 a year. They're AI of themselves. And then you can hire 5 or 6 of them, and then there'll probably be licensing stuff like it can handle 100, you know, for $10,000 a year, it'll handle 100 incidents or something like that.
Oh, right. And then you scale it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because you wouldn't want to be like, oh, I'm charging $10,000 for it. And then Bank of America comes in, they're like, boom, we'll take it. And they just run that for all there.
Right. Yeah.
Anyways, I think this is going to be an interesting place. And like you said, there's probably going to be haves and have nots, and it's going to be real interesting. There's going to be some people that make a lot of money off this, I think.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because you're going to see this is all like closed source stuff. And they're talking about, you know, OpenAI is called OpenAI, but it's not entirely open yet. But wait till, you know, you have these closed loop AIs and then someone dumps the code for another AI that you can start building your own stuff off, like that guy did for the dead people. So you're going to have other startups and other companies that are going to say, hey, well, why do we have to buy Microsoft's AI? Well, we can build our own AI in-house. You know, and you got 2 security engineers in the back with, you know, with a Raspberry Pi, and they're like, I got this. So the next, you know, 5 to 10 years are going to be interesting.
And if you can get out of the beta, try to shape it and make sure it's good and useful. That should be interesting. All right. Next article, we're going to blaze through this because we run in. 3CX thought supply chain attack was false positive. There have been lots of articles about exactly what happened with 3CX. So what I want to focus on here is specifically their response to it and supply chain attacks in general. 3CX was hit by a supply chain attack first detected by what appears to be Sentinel-1. In response to the notification, or at least response to the forum posts on their forum about it, 3CX decided to upload their executables to VirusTotal, which said they were fine. So 3CX was like, everything's cool. It's false positive. It took about a week for 3CX to admit they'd been compromised and that malware was being delivered via their product in an April 1st announcement. Weirdly enough, in that announcement, they completely ignored the March 22nd notification. They, you know, patted themselves on the back for doing such a great job of reacting so quickly to CrowdStrike telling them on March 29th that it was a problem. So they just ignored that whole week where they blew it off. And they finally conceded when CrowdStrike gave them the full details, and CrowdStrike thinks it's North Korea, and 3CX is giving customers 3 additional months for free. Woo!
Yeah, lucky them.
Yeah. I mean, that's better than credit monitoring. So in terms of things to discuss, are there no security engineers at 3CX? They uploaded to VirusTotal and that was the extent of their investigation? I can't believe the CEO said that publicly.
Yeah, that is, I wonder if they have a security team at all, or if they even told the security team what was going on.
Oh yeah, the product team may not have involved them.
Right. I mean, when I was at Customs, there was an incident that happened and the public relations department released a statement and they didn't even talk to us about it. And it was completely wrong. I mean, like 180 degrees wrong. And it was in the news and it came back with a whole bunch of stuff saying, well, Customs is purposefully obfuscating what happened and all this other stuff. It's like, no, they're just idiots. So this might be the same thing here.
Yeah, there was something in the forums where somebody initially responded to them and was like, nope, there's no problem. This is nothing at all. And I'm sure that that was just somebody on their public relations team just, you know, spitting out a standard answer. They'd asked around themselves and everybody was like, no, it's nothing.
Yeah. And talk about lazy. They've got the source code. They've got the compiled binaries. They could have looked at them instead of taking their own software and giving it to VirusTotal. And apparently don't understand how AV works because, you know, that's not exactly perfect. Say, oh, well, AV says it's fine. Oh, so obviously it is fine. I mean, just the idiocy really is astounding.
So second question that I had for them was, wonder what level of detail Sentinel One gave them that they just brushed it off with the AV search?
Well, I think if you look at Sentinel One's blog post on this, I think there was enough detail in there to at least start looking at it. I mean, it obviously wasn't extremely thorough, but there was some IOCs and stuff in there and stuff about DLL being dropped and things like that that they could have looked into for sure.
So do you have the original blog post? Because the one they have on the 29th, which is the same day that CrowdStrike gave them more information, was there one before
that? That's the only blog post I found. I guess I'm making a possible incorrect assumption that that's what they gave them on the 22nd.
I don't know because I don't know what they gave them or if they gave them anything because there was talk that the 22nd is when a forum post started. So it's possible that Sentinel One didn't go to them directly. They may have used the customers as a cutout and the customers didn't convince them.
I don't know why they would, but I mean, I can't speak for, you know, their SOP or whatever.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, is this a positive for Sentinel One because they detected it a week before CrowdStrike or anyone else? Or is this a negative because Sentinel One did a poor job of convincing 3CX that anything was wrong?
Well, if you're a customer of Sentinel One, I think from a marketing perspective, that would look good because to quote their blog post, behavioral detections prevented these Trojanized installers from running and led to immediate default quarantine. So from that aspect, if they're only the only ones to catch it, I'm not sure if CrowdStrike caught it because of their software bite it or they started looking into this for other reasons. I'm not sure. But if Sentinel-1 was the only one to catch it, and this the company, according to their website, they have 600,000 customers with 12 million daily users. So this is not like a tiny company. There are a whole lot of other security products that are running in the 600,000 customer environment.
Wow.
And Sentinel One was the only one to catch it. I think that's a really big feather in Sentinel One's cap. And, you know, and I thought SolarWinds was big with 300,000. 600,000 is crazy.
That's a lot. Especially, so Startup Pro for Sentinel, for 3CX is about $17.50 per user, it looks like, for 10 users. So I'm sure it goes down. Hold on. Let me go up to 120 users. Okay. Hold on. Either way, like 600,000 users is a lot for them to not have a security team.
No, that's 600,000 customers.
Oh my God. Oh, you're right. 12 million users. That's a lot for them to not have a security team.
Right. I can't believe their customer base is that large and their security team is that poor. But like I said, 600,000 customers, those 600,000 customers are running a ridiculous amount. It's got to be the myriad of security tools that are within that 600,000 has got to be off the charts. You know, that's a lot. So you've got MDE, you've got Symantec. I mean, tons of different vendors in there. And if SentinelOne was the only one to catch it, like I said, I think that's a big deal.
Interesting. Yeah, maybe I'll consider SentinelOne for our next time we do POC. I'm just saying that. I have no idea if I will or not.
Stop teasing. It depends on how much money Sentinel One's willing to.
A salesman just got really excited hearing that.
But like you said, they also had multiple customers reporting on their forums that they were having issues. It wasn't just Sentinel One saying, hey, there's a problem here. Other customers had reported seeing suspicious.
Yeah, and it's nice that the customers on the forums gave them apparently lists of files and directories and shell scripts to figure out. Like, they should have been able to look at their stuff and be like, that's weird. Our software doesn't affect that. Or we shouldn't be writing anything in that directory. Although maybe they use that as a reason why it couldn't be them.
Usually I make excuses. Oh, not excuses, but I can empathize with some of the challenges with other companies. But in this case, this is absolute negligence, saying that, hey, you know, your code is doing this, and they don't at least ask the developers to look into the code and say, hey, can our code do this or what, you know, anything like that. They just put it on VirusTotal and say, oh, it's just, oh, it's terrible. Absolutely terrible.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. All right. 3CX is using this as an opportunity to push their customers to their web app, which apparently does almost everything, but not quite everything the desktop app does. So why does this matter? Well, honestly, this is really common as an analyst. I used to see this all the time, where you would have an alert pop up about a previously installed product. You know, maybe there was an update, maybe your detection logic changed, something changes, and your EDR AV says it's evil. Normally, the procedure I've done or told analysts to do in the past is, you know, do some research online, check with the vendor, validate the hash is the same one where the vendor says this is our known good copy. That's just not good enough anymore, because if the vendor's a victim of a supply chain hack like this, they're going to think that's the good copy.
Well, that's the one they've been telling their customers is a good copy, because that's the one they've been pushing out.
Yeah. And especially, especially when it takes them like a week to figure out that it's bad. That's a long time to leave a attacker resident in your environment. So what should you do about it? You should adjust your response process. When you get those alerts for previously installed products that look fine on the surface, it's time to dig deeper. It's time to try and, you know, run them in a sandbox, try to figure out what exactly they're doing, go back and find the previous version, run it in the sandbox and see what's different. If you have malware reverse engineering capabilities, although that's probably against your terms of service to actually crack into the executable and see what it's doing, but you can at least, you know, put in a sandbox or in a monitored product and see, you know, is it putting shell scripts out there? Is it adding weird run keys? Is it reaching out to strange websites? Stuff like that. For our last article, I'm going to run through this super fast, so fast. It's from the Register. InfoSec bigwigs want to be head of security at Her Majesty's Treasury for $50,000. I guess it's His Majesty's Treasury now.
No, 50,000 pounds.
50,000 pounds. The Treasury Department of the UK has an open role, head of cybersecurity, which I initially thought head of cybersecurity would be the equivalent of a CISO, but apparently it's more of a mid-senior level. So it sounds like more of a senior manager.
Well, according to the way that they couched it, because if you look at the equivalent position in the U.S. Treasury, that's the SES level, you know, executive
Senior
level.
Senior executive service, yeah.
Yeah, and it pays 182.
Interesting.
Well, actually closer to 183 for that position. So what's that? Almost quadruple?
Well, I mean, now, well, once you, here? The 50,000 pounds, it translates to about 62,000 U.S., so it's about a third. Yeah, triple. So it does come with 5 weeks of leave and a defined benefit pension. According to the Register, though, the normal salary range for head of IT security in London is 80 to 100,000 pounds, which is crazy to me. London's one of the most expensive cities in the world.
That's really low ball on it.
That's less than I make, and I am not a head of IT security.
You should be, though.
But I should be. And frankly, I think, and if I remember correctly, in areas like DC and New York and San Francisco, For $80,000 to $100,000 US, which I get, the exchange rate's not exactly the same, but for a roughly similar level of expenditure, you can get an entry-level analyst.
Yeah, well, we talked about that when we did salaries before, was that the average entry-level analyst was making $80,000.
Yeah, yep. So I wonder what kind of quality candidates they're going to get for this.
Well, if you quote that CTO from Roman,
who said the salary before.
Yeah, who said the salary should be five times that, but they had a great quote, which is, if you pay peanuts, you get monkeys. But I think it should be, if you pay bananas, you get monkeys. If you pay peanuts, you get squirrels.
I mean, if he thought about it more, maybe he would have come up with a better one.
I don't know. It still sounds good.
If you pay peanuts, you get elephants. I mean, that's
funny you should say that, because that was my first edit on this when I wrote it down, was elephants. I was like, put squirrels instead. Because that's
beautiful, majestic creatures.
I think that's a joke. I'm not sure if elephants even eat peanuts. I don't know. I think that's a cartoonish thing.
That's fair.
But that's fair. Yeah, either way, I'd rather have a monkey in government than over a politician.
Enough monkeys in you stick enough monkeys in the Senate and the House of Representatives, and eventually they'll write
the Patriot Act.
The Patriot Act. Yeah, I was trying to think of some shorthand for like a bill that restricts your liberties. Patriot Act works perfectly.
Yeah. But you think, the Chancellor of the Exchequer ought to know better than this. You know, he just hires Berlin-Law for 200 and call it good.
Ridiculous. Ridiculous. All right. Why does this matter? It doesn't really. This is just ridiculous.
It's just silly. It's the reason where you've come this. Just silly Britons.
It could be worse. You could look at this and be like, man, I can't believe I'm not making as much as programmers in Silicon Valley. Well, you could also be making 50,000 pounds.
You know, this whole bananas and squirrels and, not paying enough, this could easily be turned into a great Monty Python skit.
All right. Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sept on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.